Are you good at spotting eagle nests or eagle sounds like we just heard? Well, the DNR would like your help. I'm Jill Nadeau, glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. David Drake is back with us. He is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. David will tell you how you can volunteer for that nest spotting gig and why it's important to conservation biologists. We'll also talk about urban predators and the Wisconsin Coverts program. We have lots to talk about today and welcome your wildlife questions. Join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hello, David.
Hello, Jill. How are you?
I'm good. We're in charge today.
Yes,
so
we can
talk about whatever we want to.
Look
right?
out.
But we did want to start talking about eagles nesting.
Yeah.
When do they actually start building their nests?
Well, they will start building their nests. They'll start nesting about mid-February or so here in the southern part of Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and probably, you know, depending on the weather, maybe 2 to 4 weeks later as you start moving north in the state of Wisconsin.
Okay.
But their nests are a large structure full of interwoven sticks, and they'll use that nest year after year after year. And typically, the male and female will pair for life unless something happens to one or the other. And so they'll start perhaps building the nest 3 or 4 months before the actual nesting period starts, and then they just keep adding to that. And so I think the largest bald eagle nest so far recorded was in Florida, and it was 9.5 feet wide in diameter, about 20 feet deep. So, you know, that's
just
keep stacking sticks on year after year.
Wow.
And it was estimated to weigh about 3 tons, so almost 6,000 pounds. So it's a monstrosity. And a lot of times they'll nest in the tops of white pine trees or taller pine trees that have a lot of times been topped, where either maybe a straight wind has come and taken the top of the tree off or whatever like that. So especially as the nests get larger and larger, they're easy to see generally from the ground. But then what happens is people also notify the DNR, or the biologists will find out where nests are, and then they'll start flying planes. And they're very easy to see from the sky, especially in a top tree where you don't have any canopy around that.
Right.
And it's a pretty impressive structure. And then on top of that, when the mature eagles are actually occupying the nest, you have this great big white head sitting on top of the nest. So that's a beacon also that helps draw your eye to that nest.
So when will they actually start laying those eggs?
They will start laying in March, I guess?
March or
something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. They usually lay 1 to 3 eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Incubation's about 35 days.
Okay.
So a little bit more than a month.
Mm-hmm.
And then about 10 to 12 weeks after they hatch out, until the young fledge are ready to leave the nest by flying out. And so they'll have what's called asynchronous hatching, which is a little bit different than a lot of our songbirds, where the eggs will all hatch out generally at the same time. But they'll lay an egg maybe every other day or something like that, and the eggs will hatch out in the order that they were laid. And then something else that's kind of unique about raptors, and eagles are a type of raptor along with owls and hawks and falcons and things like that. But a lot of times you'll get siblicides. So the oldest one sometimes, as they're competing for food, will sometimes push the younger sibling or siblings out of the nest, actually, so they don't have to compete, especially in times of limited food availability.
Well, I was just going to ask you that because, you know, with regular songbirds, the little one's sometimes the last one to get any food. So if they lay them like that, the little one doesn't have a whole lot of chance, does it?
Yep. Or you have to be pretty strong. And,
sure.
If you make it, you're pretty tough.
Sure. Absolutely. So why is it important for these statistics to get to the DNR and other resources?
Well, I think, obviously the bald eagle is a special animal in the United States history. Obviously it's the national bird, a national animal. An aside, Ben Franklin wanted to name the national turkey, or the turkey is the national bird, but the bald eagle, I think, is a little bit more majestic. And so it's an interesting story. It's a great comeback story because they suffered from the pesticide DDT and had limited breeding success and things like that because of the DDT issues, and were on the endangered species list for a long period of time. And there's hundreds of species, there are thousands of species on the endangered species list if you consider both plants and animals. And very few of those species, once they get on that list, actually get recovered to the point where the population is sustainable enough or healthy enough that you can actually delist them.
Right.
And the bald eagle is one of those species. So it's pretty remarkable in that regard. And I think it was like 2007, The bald eagle was taken off the U.S. Endangered species list. So that was pretty
impressive. We love a comeback story,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my gosh. We love a comeback story.
And in Wisconsin, is just great, ideal bald eagle habitat. It's got a lot of wooded areas, especially in the northern part of the state. They like to nest in those tall pine trees. So we have a lot of pines up in the – that was the historic forest structure in northern Wisconsin. And we've got a lot of lakes, and they like to use those lakes to fish.
Yeah.
So we just have ideal habitat here. And the DNR saw last year they had about a 27% increase in eagles in the southeastern part of the United States, or southeastern part of the Wisconsin. And I think they said they saw occupied eagle nests in 71 of the 72 counties. And so now they think that the eagle population is actually reaching its carrying capacity, because they've actually seen nests where they don't think they can nest any more places in some of these counties.
Mm-hmm. So it's probably going to level off a little bit?
Probably, and I think it sounds like they're starting to see that up in kind of the west central and the northern part, northwestern part of the state, where they think that it's reached carrying capacity up that way.
And we've talked a few times about eagles on the show, and we've had people calling and say that there are nests in Milwaukee County now.
Yeah, yep, so they are definitely become more of an urban adapted bird. And I was in Pittsburgh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and there were some bald eagle nests on the one of the rivers there, you know, in the city limits of Pittsburgh. So, and I see them. I live in Middleton. I see them flying over Middleton quite often and things like that. So, you know, that I'm not sure what that threshold is in terms of the amount of urbanization that they're willing to tolerate, but they certainly can tolerate some for sure. And the other thing I think is kind of neat about Wisconsin and the bald eagles, and this is a nice testament to both the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is has authority over federal species, as well as our state Department of Natural Resources. But I think it's either 13 or 17 different states in the country that Wisconsin has donated eagles to those states.
Really?
Wow, for repopulating great. Eagles in those states. And that's just such a nice testament that Wisconsin has done just a phenomenal job, not only managing the habitat, but all the habitat they have available. And then to be able to go and help other states to kind of restore their bald eagle populations is kind of a nice heartwarming story.
Yeah, for sure. And some of those lucky eagles that got to go to, Florida?
That's right.
Now, what are some other ways that the citizen scientists have helped with the eagle population and just gathering data?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, alerting the DNR where you see nests. And so if you could do that, just so they're aware that the nest is there, and perhaps they don't know the nest is there, they'll go out and investigate. And so you can probably the best thing to do is just Google Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and then bald eagle nests, and the coordinator of that program, her name is Laura, I think it's pronounced Jaskiewicz. So she should pop up, and you can email her, and then they'll send a county biologist out in that county. And as I mentioned, a lot of times they'll put a plane up in the air and they'll start flying to do an inventory of bald eagle nests or to verify that they're there. And that's the best thing to do. And then once they've located the nest, again, like I mentioned, you know, the bald eagles use that nest year after year after year. So once they use that, once they find that nest, then they'll just continually monitor it. But it also allows the DNR to alert people that eagles are nesting in that area and to kind of avoid the nest, because they are somewhat sensitive to nest disturbance.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, you might see it. How close should you really even get to it?
Probably stay about as far away as you can.
Okay.
And I'm not sure what the rule. I know there's a rule for it. Sure. I just don't know what that buffer distance is. And I should mention, even though they're not covered through the Endangered Species Act anymore, that they are covered through the Federal Migratory Bird Act, and they're also covered through the Bald Eagle and Golden Eagle Federal Act as well. So they're a protected species in other ways, even though they're no longer endangered.
Sure, and that's what binoculars are for.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a phone call coming in, or actually it was an email from Barb in Menominee. She said she has 2 feeders, talking about birds, for her birds, and she normally refills them once a week or so. But this year, she put the feeders out in mid-December, and they have yet to be refilled. And she wants to know what happened to the birds.
Yep, Barb, that is a very common question from a lot of different people here in Wisconsin. And there's a number of, I don't know the definitive answer, but there's a number of plausible explanations. And one is, we have had a relatively mild winter.
We have. Knock on wood.
Knock on wood. That's right. We're almost through it. And so not only have we had relatively mild temperatures, but we also have had not a ton of consistent snowfall on the ground. And so,
at least down here in the south. Up north, they've
true.
Got
good
plenty.
Point. Yep, yeah. Good point. I'm very south-centric sometimes. That's right, because I live
and
down
our
here.
Listeners let us know when we do that. So.
As they should. Absolutely. So in areas where we don't have consistent snow cover, You know, the food is not covered under the snow. And when we have relatively mild temperatures, those birds are not burning a ton of energy to try to stay warm like they would, this time last February when we had the polar vortex.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes they may not be coming to your feeder simply because they don't need that food availability, simply because they have other food, natural food sources that are accessible to them, and or they're not eating through that natural food source as quickly as they would if we had a sustained, really cold winter. The other possibility is that a lot of other people in your neighborhood are also putting up feeders, and they might be coming to those feeders instead of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be coming to your feeder, you just may not be seeing them, although obviously you're not refilling your feeders, so they're not draining your feeder, so they may not be coming there as often as they normally should be. But typically, I think the concern with a question like this is something going on with the birds where the bird populations are declining, and that typically is not the case, especially for feeder birds.
Mm-hmm.
Those are pretty common, and the species or the populations for those species are generally healthy.
Now, she's had her feed in her bird feeder for, gosh, over a month now. She should be concerned that it's going to mold or whatever.
Possibly, especially as it gets warmer. Mm-hmm. Then you start getting into that issue about being concerned about moldy seed, especially if you're feeding oiled sunflower seed and seed that has a really high oil content to it.
Okay.
For sure. But that's maybe something to look at for her feeder right now, is just to make sure that the seed looks like it's mm-hmm. good, in good condition. If not, empty it out, throw it away. You know, do a mild wash of your feeder with maybe some like a 1-10 Clorox water mix or a warm soapy water mix. Make sure you rinse it really well, dry it before you put the seed back in, and then hang it again.
Yeah. Okay. We did also get a picture from Dwayne, who wants to know what this predator may be. it's some kind of fox, maybe, with black ears, white front, very pretty.
Yep, it looks like a kind of a silver version of a fox.
Okay.
A blackish silver version of a fox. Certainly has the face of it, with the black legs and so typically it's a version of a red fox.
Okay.
And they have different red fox. Obviously, is the most common coat color,
right?
And that's why they call it a red fox. And we don't see the one thing that would be definitive of a red fox is you would see a white tip to the tail.
Oh,
we can't see the tail in this picture.
No, we can't.
But red fox have typically black. The backs of their ears are black. They have black legs, which this one does. It looks like so.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different melanistic version of a red fox.
And it's quite lovely. So.
It is.
All right. Well, thanks for the picture, Dwayne. You're listening to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tyler Ditter is our technical director today, and Sasha Van Allen is our on-air producer. We are talking wildlife today, and we've been discussing bald eagle nests and other bird-related topics. With us is David Drake. He's a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. Have you helped spot eagle nests? What was that like? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And of course, we can take any of your other wildlife questions. Speaking of birds, what are we seeing at those bird feeders are out and about this time of year?
Yeah, so typically it would be, at a typical backyard bird feeder, cardinals, blue jays, grackles, a whole variety of sparrows perhaps. English sparrows are the house sparrow, which is the invasive non-native species of sparrow, but you might also see song sparrows, fox sparrows, depending where you are, juncos,
mm-hmm.
doves, perhaps nuthatches, a variety of woodpeckers, things like that. And it does not look like many of the early migratory birds are back up here yet. So I have not seen or heard cedar waxwings or robins. Sometimes bluebirds are starting to come up, and it might be a little early for bluebirds,
mm-hmm.
Things like that. But so, and I haven't heard or seen those, and in talking to some other people who are birding, they haven't seen it either. So soon enough, we'll get them here, and that's a nice sign that spring is on the way eventually and winter's going to break.
Definitely, definitely. Well, if you've seen some birds that you don't normally see this time of year, why don't you give us a call? All the lines are open, 800-642-1234. David, you wanted to talk a bit about urban predators, and there have been a few attacks reported in some pretty highly populated areas. Why don't you tell us about those?
Yeah, I thought we'd just maybe talk about that because it's in the news. And I know when animals start attacking people, people's concerns start to rise and the anxiety rises a little bit here.
Reasonable,
and,
you know.
Reasonable. You know, the other thing here in Madison, we just had a verified account of a bobcat over in kind of in the West Madison, Verona area. Somebody caught the bobcat going across their front porch of their front door on their front door camera at like 8:15 in the morning. So it was an awesome video, and the bobcat looks, you know, healthy, and it was really cool to see it. But the concern of the person who sent it in is, you know, am I safe? Are my kids safe? Or how about my pets and things like that?
What about their packages?
The packages, you know? Exactly. So the bobcat could be taking that. And then, you know, there's been a couple stories in the newspaper or in the news media recently about the coyote attack in Chicago on that young kid by the Lincoln Park Zoo, for example. There was a coyote attack in a couple towns in New Hampshire where this one coyote ended up not faring so well that the dad actually strangled the coyote to death after it attacked his kid. And and the coyote had attacked a car before that, and I think a 63-year-old woman and her pet, you know, all within an hour time.
Okay.
And that coyote turned out to be rabid.
I was going to say, that doesn't sound real safe for anybody.
So, you know, but generally, we have bobcats that are living not necessarily in Midwestern cities, but they're living in Los Angeles and Phoenix and Houston and Dallas and things like that. We've got coyotes that live in cities all across North America, including, you know, Madison, Milwaukee. They're permanent citizens, residents of the city, you know, things like that. And so these animals are around us. They're not leaving us in the city. A lot of times you don't even know they're there because they avoid people a lot of times. And it's generally a very benign experience where, you know, nothing bad happens, even if you do encounter a coyote. And so it's just, you know, to make people aware that there's nothing to be overly concerned about because these animals have probably been living around you for as long as you've been living in that house, more or less, especially in the last few decades. And if you do see a coyote or a bobcat or a fox or whatever the case might be, you know, enjoy that sighting, but enjoy it from a safe distance. And then after you have watched the animal for a few minutes, then make sure that you scare the animal. So haze it in some capacity where you wave your arms in big wide circles and you yell at the animal, or maybe you throw a stick or a rock or a snowball, not to hit the animal, but in the close proximity to the animal. Just the best thing that we can do as human beings is to instill fear of humans in these animals so that when they see us, they move away from us. And that should be the proper response from any of these animals you try to haze, is they may not run away from you, but they should walk away or move away from you. And if they're not, then be a little bit more aggressive with your hazing. And if they either move towards you or are aggressive toward you, then either call the county biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources or your local police department and report the sighting, the time that happened, the date, the location, and things like that, so that they can start tracking that animal or the animals that might be in that general area. But generally, you know, even though you're hearing all these accounts recently in the media, and the media does typically play up negative things more than they do positive things, that this is nothing necessarily new, that these animals aren't all of a sudden in the city, and you're not at any more risk than you ever have been. So,
and also, we all tend to have more cameras around our house, so we're likely to catch them where we didn't before.
Absolutely.
So, okay, great. And don't feed them, right?
Yes, definitely not feed them.
Do not feed them. All right, well, let's go to the phones. We've got John in Waterloo who has something to talk to us about. Hi, John.
Good morning. I just... saw a bird of prey and actually hit the brakes to turn around and get a closer look because I know my birds of prey fairly well, but I didn't recognize this one right off the bat. And then I turned on the radio, and here you are answering questions about wildlife.
So. We're here for you, John.
So it had a very white belly, and the wings were gray with black tips on the ends. I would say it was a medium-sized hawk, certainly not as large as a red tail. I also had a white spot above its tail on its rump, on the top side.
Was it perched or flying?
It was flying.
And was it flying over kind of an open area, like a grassy field or an ag field or something like that?
Correct.
Yeah. So, the name is just escaping right now. But it was typically the what people would typically call that is a chicken hawk. But dang it, the name is gonna. I'm gonna have to come back to you, John, on that on the name because I know exactly. I can see it.
Well, we'll get Tyler on that. He's
I know exactly what it is because when you said the white rump, but and it's a very common hawk that flies over over prairies and open land areas and things like that. Mm-hmm.
Cooper's hawk.
No, it's not a Cooper's hawk.
Oh, it's not.
No, it's definitely not a Cooper's hawk. John, I will as soon as my brain reactivates. I'll blurt out the name, but I know exactly what you're talking about, and I'm pretty sure I know that the identity of that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the sighting there, John. Appreciate that. Let's go on now to Dale. Dale's in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Dale.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
We're up here. Chippewa Falls is up in west central Wisconsin, and by the way, we have had a lot of snow here this year, so... And we noticed in our yard, it was after Christmas, a couple robins in our yard yet. And I was over a couple weeks later in a neighbor's yard, and she has a heated bird feeder out. And we saw some there, and she said they've been there all winter. Now, that's been, you know, a good month now. But this was into January. Well into January, they were there. And she said she had five of them. They all looked, and I'm not sure how to tell a male and female, but they looked really fat and healthy, big red puffy breasts, and they were in her feeder and or in her bird bath, and she watched them. She said they come every day. They're in a they'll perch in a tree, and then they all get in that bird bath, and we saw four out of the five of them come in the bird bath. So my question is, what's happening here? I mean, it's just, are robins adapting? And then if that's the case, what should you put out to feed them?
Yeah, that's a good question. So robins are, we think of them as a migratory species, but they're what we would call an eruptive migratory bird. So sometimes, depending on the winter conditions, sometimes they're here, especially in southern Wisconsin. They can be here year-round, and they really don't migrate out of our area. Other winters, they will migrate out of our area. And so that's what you're seeing, is there's probably enough food and available habitat for them that they're able to stay there for the winter. And the trade-off between birds that stay here for the winter versus flying south into a warmer climate is that when you're flying south, there's a lot of energy you're burning to migrate out of the area, and there's risks involved with migration. So you're flying across a lot of habitat or territory you may not be aware of, and so there's things you might run into, like buildings or tall communication towers, and kill yourself that way. There's added predation because you're exposed a lot more as you're flying south, in addition to just the amount of energy you're burning. Now, the risk, the trade-off is once you get someplace warm, you can kick your feet up and have a couple of pina coladas and you're good to go. the risk for staying up here then is that you're burning energy a lot more frequently, you know, surviving the winter conditions, but you don't have to take that risk to fly south. And so that's what you're seeing. Those animals will make that decision kind of a game time decision to some extent. But sometimes you'll see robins here all winter, and sometimes you won't. And it all depends a little bit on the conditions, especially in those local areas.
And what would you feed
you
feed them?
So typically we think of robins as eating insects. So,
right.
But there are some in these microclimate areas, especially where you have southern exposure, you're out of the wind, there are insects available sometimes on trees or in those types of areas, especially, you know, if you fly fish in the wintertime, you'll see these hatches even in December coming off in the water sometimes. So there are insects around in the wintertime, just not as abundant as they are in the warmer months. But the other thing, if you have a platform feeder, you can get mealworms or something like that, and that's a really good thing to feed the robins as well.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks for the question, Dale.
And the hawk.
Yes, the hawk.
Northern harrier.
Northern
hawk. Yeah.
Harrier.
Yep.
Okay.
And so it's a soaring hawk. It's a kind of what we call a buteo. It's in that family. And they've got that white rump on them. Beautiful bird. Big wings. And that probably is exactly what I would suspect John's seen. So, John, look up Northern Harrier.
Okay.
Harrier. And see if that's what you saw.
Great. So maybe like the term chicken hawk is a very broad
term. Yeah. Yep, it is.
Okay, so don't use that now, Dan.
No, that's right. Yeah. What's the taxonomy on that?
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's go to Todd. Todd's in Winter. Hello. Todd, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's your question?
No, I have a question. So I live on the Wolf River between and Winnicott, Wisconsin, north of Oshkosh on the Big Lake between Winnebago, Huygen, Petermore, and I often have, I mean, every day I have multiple eagles flying. And obviously the river's open, so they're looking for birds, but I never see a nest. So I'm just curious. I would like to help out, you know, nest sighting and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Todd, so, Todd, are they mature eagles? Do you see the white head and white tail on them?
This morning before I left my house, there was 3 matures and 3 juveniles.
Okay.
And the ducks are here constantly right now. They open water.
Yeah.
Banzer and buffalheads. And I actually saw for the first time juveniles trying to go get those ducks. I always thought, geez, this should be able to catch these things that come up the water. They die.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and we don't have a great connection there, Todd. So.
Yeah, and so juveniles obviously are not old enough to mate, so they
right.
would not be
they
nesting.
Wouldn't have a nest.
That's the reason for that question. Mm-hmm. But since you saw adults there, there's a number of possibilities. So the adult males, when they are nesting, they are territorial. So it might just be that there's a nest someplace outside of your viewing area, but within that territory still, and those eagles are keeping all the other eagles out from that nesting territory and not allowing them to nest there. So that's a possibility. It might just be that you don't have suitable nesting habitat in your area and there's not a nest there because the habitat isn't appropriate for what they're looking for. And there might just be a nest nearby and you just can't see it because
sure.
maybe the trees are so thick or whatever the case might be.
So how big is an eagle territory? I mean, I know it's relative.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm. It probably depends on how much space they need, what's available in terms of resources for how close they need or how close it is to their hunting grounds, fishing grounds, whatever the case might be.
Okay.
But you know, they can fly in a one-way span. They might fly 30 miles one way between where they're roosting and where they're feeding. So
okay.
it can be relatively large yeah. sometimes.
So they could be yeah. flying in from somewhere
yeah,
else.
For sure.
Okay. All right, great. Let's go to Stoughton next. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, every year I judge my spring by red wings. We live by a marsh, and last week we had red wing blackbirds.
Wow, that is
yep.
early, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. So they're one of the earlier migratory returners, too. So, and it might be a little bit early for them, but again, they're going to come up here when they feel the conditions are suitable for them to survive. And
mm-hmm.
The obvious advantage for coming up early is you get a jump on the best breeding habitat, best breeding territory. And the better breeding territory you can stake your claim to and defend, then you've got a better chance of attracting a good female, and then you can actually pass on those strong genes. So
mm-hmm.
that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get up here and get a jump on the breeding territories before some of the other
Wonderful.
Red-winged blackbirds
yeah.
do.
Good sign of spring for us. So.
Yeah,
for sure.
And especially in those marshes, you know, the those cattail marshes in particular,
yeah.
they're
they love
pretty,
those.
They love them, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of thermal insulation in there for them. So even though the wind might be howling, it might seem cold, they'll just kind of duck down toward the bottom of those cattails, and, mm-hmm. and it's nice and toasty down there.
Mm-hmm. So you have prime real estate for red-winged blackbirds, Jackie. Thanks for the call. Up next, we've got Steve in Lake Geneva. Steve, you there?
Yes, I am. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I know you already got the answer to the Northern Harrier, also a marsh hawk.
Yes, thank you, though.
But I just wanted to comment also on robins. I've had quite a number of robins in my backyard. I have a garden pond with a little waterfall that I keep going all winter, and that seems to help attract the robins. And, you know, I know my dad and I used to go out way back when I was young to wherever there were open springs, and you would see robins all winter long. So they definitely hang around if they can. And actually, I saw another interesting one was a great blue heron about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Oh, are they back?
So, yeah. So
not sure if he ever left.
Oh, okay.
Yep, they may not have. And so most likely why you've got robins there, Steve, I think you hit the nail on the head, is that open water that you have. And it also, you've got some movement to that water, so that water makes noise, and the birds can hear it. But that open water is hugely beneficial, especially in the wintertime, because a lot of our open water sources are either bound up as ice or they're covered under snow. And so where you have open water, those animals will certainly come to that. So that's a really good thing. And if you can keep that open, you're going to have a lot more wildlife at your pond than perhaps your neighbors who don't have an open water source. And the blue herons, they will stick around. You know, you see them a lot of times, especially down here in the southern part of the state, if you've got an open water source like a commercial park and they've got a bubbler or a fountain or a spring that's open year-round, something like that. We'll also see belted kingfishers down, especially down here in the southern part of the state, mm-hmm. throughout the winter. But again, only if there's an open water source
okay.
around.
And there's probably a lot more this year than there has been.
Yeah, I think so.
So, okay, so let's go to Bill in Elkhorn. Was that Elkhorn, Bill?
Yes.
Okay, and what's your question?
I built a nesting box for either kestrels or screech owls, and I'm wondering how far away from my house I should place it. I live on, my house is set on 50 acres of farmland with some woods and some recovering natural prairie, and I'm just kind of looking for guidelines on where it should be placed and, you know, maybe how high above the ground and what direction to face it.
Yeah, Bill, that's a great thing you did. So wonderful. And I don't know exactly how far you should put it from your house. I would maybe suggest the further the better. And if you can put it, you know, a lot of times if you go up toward the Buena Vista Marsh around Stevens Point, you see kestrel boxes that have been put up there. And a lot of times they're put on utility poles. And if you do that, I think you probably need to at least check in with the utility company and make sure they don't mind you doing something like that. But, you know, the taller the better, too. If you can get it up maybe 20 feet off the ground or so, that would be ideal. And in terms of the direction, I think if you could probably get it maybe faced away from the prevailing wind and weather so that the face of the box is opposite the prevailing wind and weather, that probably would be also beneficial.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
But that's neat. And they'll come to them. Those
will
kestrels,
they?
Yeah, they'll use those. They're a cavity nesting bird. So they'll come to them, and kestrels are super cool. They're a falcon.
Small, right?
Yep, they're a small little bird type of falcon. A lot of times you'll see them sitting up on telephone wires. As you're driving along, especially country roads, and like most of the falcons, they have sideburns, so that's one of the things. And they're just a beautifully colored bird as well. So, and kestrels, another thing that's kind of cool about them is that they will kind of hover in place as they're hunting, similar to a hummingbird. So that's that's kind of neat to see them.
Wow, I'll have to take a look. So, are they all over the state then?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Great. Well, thanks, Bill. Thanks for bringing that up, and good luck. I hope you attract a few of those. If you've got a question for Dave, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always send us an email. That's ideas@wpr.org. David, originally we were talking about urban predators, and that kind of leads to something we were talking about earlier. Now, we're all kind of concerned about this coronavirus, and that origin is an animal, isn't it?
Yeah. So obviously the new coronavirus is in the news right now, and that's a new strain. Coronaviruses are a pretty common large group of viruses that include colds and, you know, SARS was a coronavirus, MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, that was a coronavirus and things like that.
Sort of a generic term.
Yeah. And the reason they call it a coronavirus apparently is because if you look at it under the microscope, the virus has all these kind of spikes emanating from it. It looks like a corona or a crown. Mm-hmm. So that's why they call them the coronavirus. And yeah, the interesting thing about this one is that they think that it originated from most likely a bat species, and a number of these coronaviruses do originate from wildlife. So I think the MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, originated. I think that was the one that originated from a camel. This coronavirus, I think, originated from a bat. Although it also appears that there's person-to-person transmission as well. But one of the things that's interesting about this is that there was a paper published in Science back in, I don't know, 2007 or 2008. So this is a little bit dated. But the authors of that paper suggested that I think it was like 65% of all new emerging infectious diseases. So that would be like the Zika virus or Ebola or the coronavirus we're seeing now. About 65% of those emerging infectious diseases are zoonotic, which means that they jump across species lines. So zoonotic means it'll jump from an animal to humans. And so of 65%, about, I think it's like 78% of those emerging infectious diseases are originating in species of wildlife. So this becomes an issue because about 50% of our world is urbanized right now. So 50% of our world population is living in an urban setting. About 85% of the American population is living in an urbanized setting. And by 2050, the projection is that about 70% of the world population will be living in an urbanized landscape. In these urbanized areas, we have a high concentration of people. So when people do get diseases, they actually can spread through that close, high concentrated group of people very quickly. But you have a lot of wildlife. And we talked about this a little bit with some of those coyotes and the bobcats and things like that on these urban landscapes. So there's a lot of wildlife living in very close proximity amongst these human centers of dense human populations. And so when you start thinking about these emerging infectious diseases being zoonotic, you know, that is of some concern. And I know, like, the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control in the United States are obviously aware of this, and they're doing all they can to kind of fight that. But, you know, this is another idea or another reason just to always make sure you keep your distance from animals, you know, in the city as well when you see them. And it's great to have them. And again, we're not ever going to eradicate the animals in the city, nor should we.
No.
They add a tremendous amount of value to our life in all sorts of different ways. But just be smart about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I think as we start thinking about what do cities do for us and how do we plan out future cities and things like that, it would be awesome if we not just thought about developing cities with humans first and foremost in mind, but thinking about that entire ecosystem. And you know, if you were able to lay out a city, how would you do that so that maybe you have green buffer zones, so you have a separation between humans and wildlife and things like that, so mm-hmm. that you've got you can start cutting down on some of these attacks that we hear about occasionally, or you can reduce the chance of zoonotic diseases jumping species lines and getting to human beings and things like that. So it's just something interesting to think about. But it is interesting that you know, these coronaviruses are originating from bats. In particular, this one new coronavirus is originating from bat species,
sure.
I think.
Yeah, well, great things to think about. Plan for the future.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's get the next caller from Green Bay. It's Rick. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Yes, I have thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I have an observation. Last fall, during the fall migration, we live right on the shore of Green Bay, and there was a small flock of mergansers out there, and we had about 5 eagles that were flying in and out of the trees, and whenever they got close to the mergansers would tighten up their flock, and they would all flap their wings, not to fly, but just to create splashing and just visual chaos. And I assume they were doing that so that the eagles could not pick out any single bird. But I had never seen that before. Is that common?
Rick, I haven't heard of that either, but it certainly makes sense as you describe it, for sure. You know, and it's kind of similar to that school of fish as a shark or a predator comes, you know. If you're one big clump, it's a lot mm-hmm. Harder for that predator to pick out one individual than it is if you're just out there by yourself. So kind of what you described makes sense. And as they're flapping their wings, it also might make the bird, the mergansers, look bigger to the eagle. So maybe now all of a sudden it's not as easy a prey item as it once looked like when they were smaller.
Sure. Well, great observation, Rick. Our guest today is David Drake. He is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Please tune in tomorrow at 11 because it's time to look at the list of 2019's top 10 consumer complaints with our guests from the Bureau of Consumer Protection. That's tomorrow right here on the Ideas Network. But right now we are talking about wildlife. So let's go right to the phones. And we've had Barbara online from Grand Marsh. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, this is a very, very amusing story. Every year we go to Naples, Florida, and we go to Corkscrew Swamp.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We walk the boardwalk. Now, I have to preface it by saying I'm from Chicago, where robins are everywhere, and I'm 80 years old, and so I've seen a million robins. As we're walking on the boardwalk, one of the rangers comes creeping up in front of us and says, "Shh. Be very, very quiet, and you'll be able to see a robin."
It's all relative.
That's great.
And that was so exciting to them. And of course, I didn't let on. And I said, "Oh, we really wanted to see an alligator, not a robin."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
That's a great story.
That is a great Corkscrew Swamp is just a phenomenal place down there too. And I think alligators would have been cool, but a roseate spoonbill or a wood stork would have been awesome to see down that area too.
Mm-hmm, definitely. All right. Well, let's go on to Bernice. Is that in St. Croix?
Denise.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So about a year and a half ago, in June, a wild grouse befriended me. I mean, it just is super friendly. It'll sit on my lap. It jumps up on my shoulder. It when
wow.
I'm outside, it follows me around like a little puppy dog. So my question is, how common is that? And then the second question is, how do I tell what gender it is?
Ah, so I'm guessing, are you assuming, you're talking about a ruffed grouse, right?
Yes.
Yeah, So that's really interesting. It's interesting for a whole host of reasons. Number one, that's not the most common place for a ruffed grouse to be in the state of Wisconsin, first off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting, it's down there. And I'm wondering if it was not a captive-bred bird that escaped, and that's why it's so tame. And comes to you like it does.
That makes a lot of sense.
Because that is a really strange place for ruffed grouse to be in the state of Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
First off. So I'm wondering if that's what's going on and why it's so domesticated, quote unquote, like that. And I'm sorry, Denise, what was the second part of your question?
What gender?
Oh, the gender. Yeah. So it sometimes it's hard to determine that. Typically, a lot of times with birds, especially when the male and female look alike, is you would look at the cloacal vent to see if it's a male or female. But obviously, if you can look and see if that bird is in the springtime, if it starts to drum or you know, that's an obvious indication that it's a male as well.
Okay, so there's no real feathering
difference. Not too much, yeah.
Okay.
Not too much. You can look. I'm trying to think about on the tail feathers because the center tail feathers, and I know if somebody's out there, remind me of this. It's either the center tail feathers it indicates male. I'm sorry, adult, subadult, or it indicates male female. I can't remember which one it is.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, you look at the cloacal vent
to
sex them.
Okay, well, good luck with that one, Denise. All right. You know, before we get any further, we wanted to talk a little bit about the Wisconsin Coverts program. Now, that's Jamie's, right?
Yep.
Jamie Knack, who's usually on here with David. Tell us, number one, what's a covert?
Well, covert is an English term for cover.
Ah.
And so it might be a brush cover. It might be some natural, shrub or thicket, something like that, that's providing cover.
Okay.
And the Coverts program is a program that is supported and underwritten by the Ruffed Grouse Society.
Mm-hmm.
So it's timely that we just talked about grouse. And then Jamie has secured some other funding through, I think, Sustainable Forest Initiative and some other places like that to support the program. But essentially, it's a forest landowner program. And now is the time to apply. Applications are being accepted until June 15th. If you go online, if you just Google Wisconsin Coverts Program, so C-O-V as in Victor, E-R-T-S, C-O-V-E-R-T-S. If you Google Wisconsin Coverts Program, the website should pop up, and you'll see the link to the application there and apply. And then this year, the Coverts Program is August 13th through the 16th, and it's at the Kemp Natural Resource Station, which is one of the UW Ag Research Stations research stations in the state. It's up by Minocqua and Lake Tomahawk, and it's a three-day landowner workshop. So you show up about midday on Thursday, and then you'll leave about midday on Sunday. And it's a mix between classroom instruction, where we have a number of people that come through and talk about forest land ownership, management of forest lands. We give you a whole wide variety of wildlife identification. We talk about invasive species. We talk about timber harvests, all sorts of things like that. And then there's a lot of hands-on. So you go out on different field trips. We teach you how to inventory your property for wildlife and things of that nature. So a couple of good things about it is it's absolutely free. It does not cost the forest landowner anything other than getting there
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of 72 hours of your time.
Because you stay right there.
You stay right there, yep. You get to interact with a bunch of other very passionate forest landowners. And so you learn probably as much from the other participants, as you do from the speakers there. Scott Craven's there. He cooks and he feeds you, so you usually leave about 10 pounds heavier than you came. And it is an awesome program. And so, again, it's underwritten by the Ruffed Grouse Society. So we focus a lot on ruffed grouse management, woodcock management, early successional forest management, and things like that. But there's a whole host of wildlife species ranging from reptiles and amphibians, which we talk about, to birds, to mammals that also benefit from all the practices that will benefit ruffed grouse. So if you're interested as a forest landowner, by all means, please look into that program. If you are in the Wisconsin Woodlands Owners Association and one of the chapters, if you reach out to some of the chapter members, I'm sure people have already attended the coverage program and can provide you some testimonial and so share their experience with you. But it is a great, great program, and Jamie does a phenomenal job of running it.
And you don't have to have a certain amount of acreage, correct?
You don't. I think a minimum of 10 acres, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. And Jamie's going to slug me if I get this wrong. But you know, in the state of Wisconsin, most forest land ownership, I think, is 20 acres or less, is most of the land ownership. So most forest land owners are small tracts of forest land. But what we're trying to encourage you to do is work with your neighboring landowners to build contiguous habitat if possible.
Just as a note, too, there's only 25 spaces. So if you're interested, look into it fairly quickly.
Yep, absolutely. But applications are accepted until June 15th. And I think nobody will be selected for the program for this coming August until the applications are in.
Nice.
But definitely, if you have any questions, go to the website again and also contact Jamie. And she'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
And I believe I did put a link on our program note on our website. So if you want a direct link, you can go to WPR.org/Larry, and that should be there.
Yep.
And let's go back to the phone, and we've got Pete, and Pete is in Bellevue, Iowa. Hi, Pete.
Hi, great to talk to you guys today. Just one quick comment. I have a friend in South America that sadly says that robins are often shot because they're considered as pests in South America, which is disappointing, but that's what he told me. The question I have is these kestrels again. Obviously, I do see them on my county road. They're delightful birds. Once those red-winged blackbirds come, they're very territorial and very tenacious, and the kestrels disappear as soon as those red-winged blackbirds set up their territory. Where do the kestrels either migrate or move to? Because obviously they can't fight off the badgering of those blackbirds.
Pete, I'm not going to answer your question until you get that Iowa caucus thing straightened out, okay? So you get that straightened out and you call right back.
I agree with that.
So, you know, I have not observed that observation you just recalled about kestrels leaving an area when red-winged blackbirds come in. Now, red-winged blackbirds certainly they're extremely aggressive and they're very, very territorial, especially when they're nesting. And I've seen them chase sandhill cranes out of an area and all sorts of other things like that. But, you know, typically kestrels are more of an open land bird. So in farm fields, you know, short grasslands, things like that. Whereas a red-winged blackbird are typically more of a marsh bird, like a cattail bird. Not to say that kestrels and red-winged blackbirds wouldn't overlap, and maybe especially on the edges of where those habitats come together. But I haven't seen that. And if the kestrels aren't going, they especially at that time of the year, kestrels are probably nesting. And what they might be doing is they might just be coming to hunt and then moving out of the area if there's nothing there. And then they'll go back and actually, you know, start to kind of stay around their nesting territory in the nest box or wherever the nest might be. So I guess I haven't witnessed that observation you've talked about. And I don't necessarily know if I have a really good explanation for it.
Well, if anybody else has seen that, you know, give us a call. We're always looking for first hand information there. So let's go to Jim next. And Jim is in Holman, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have some statistics here I'd like to share. In our area, I'm talking about southwest Wisconsin, northeast Iowa, southeast Minnesota, there was an annual wintering golden eagle survey that took place on January 25th. This year's survey counted 119 golden eagles.
Yeah. Wow.
And eagles. That was just one day that those were counted. So I thought that was very interesting and also very good news for the eagle population.
Yeah, for sure. And we are seeing more and more golden eagles moving into especially western Wisconsin here. And they are, that is an impressive bird. You know, we think about how big a bald eagle is. Golden eagles are bigger than bald eagles are. And a lot of times people will sometimes mistake an immature bald eagle for a mature golden eagle because that immature bald eagle is lacking the white head.
Mm-hmm.
And golden eagles obviously are primarily a darker bird consistently throughout their body. But, yeah, they are neat birds, and they're just that's a big bird when you see them. Especially if you see one of those compared to a bald eagle.
So basically what, along the Mississippi, you're going to more likely see them?
Yeah, so golden eagles are typically more of a western United States species. And so they're just pushing east now. And so right now, yeah, we typically see them more in the western part of the state. But I suspect that they're going to keep pushing east in our state and east into the United States. Who knows?
Are they similar to the bald eagle and then they build nests?
Yep,
and,
yep, okay. Absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very similar.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Thanks for that call, Jim. We really appreciate it. And just real quick now, David, you're going to be down at the Garden Expo this
yes.
weekend. What are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to talk on Friday about urban wildlife. So that's a big focus.
What a surprise.
I know. That's a big focus of what I do. So I'm going to talk about how you could attract species to your property and why you'd want to do that.
Okay. Do you know what time you'll be?
12:15 on Friday afternoon, I believe.
On Friday
yeah.
afternoon.
And then
oh,
Jamie has a talk that afternoon on wildlife damage.
Okay. And you know what she'll be talking about? You said
wildlife damage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. Well, that's always very important. We're talking with David Drake. He is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extensions. And we're going to be back with more after this look at the news. There's your clue. It's Wildlife Wednesday, and we're talking with David Drake today. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network. David is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension Wildlife Specialist. Do you have a wildlife question on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to us at ideas@wpr.org. We have a couple of open lines, so get those fingers going and give us a call. Now, David, we always tell people what you do for a living. So you're a professor of forest and wildlife ecology, and you're also with the Extension. So what do you do in those jobs?
Yeah, so I'm I have a 75% Extension appointment and a 25% research appointment.
Interesting.
And I try to integrate my research program with my Extension program. And so what I primarily do, I've kind of recreated myself over a number of times over my career.
It's important.
Based on you know what the funding availability is. But,
sure.
But the one common thing I've had running throughout all of my careers, I've always had some focus on urban wildlife management. And so that's what I primarily have done for the last probably 10 years or so, like almost solely focused on that, and probably will do for the rest of my career, as a matter of fact. And one of the reasons I'm so interested in it is because, like as I mentioned, about 85% of the United States population lives in urbanized areas. And so that's where people interact with wildlife. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's not like previous generations where people leave the city to go out into the country to recreate, to hunt or bird watch or hike or whatever. You know, very few people leave that urbanized area where they live anymore. And so, and most of those interactions are occurring where people are living. So that's the place where I feel like I've got the most potential for impact. And trying to help people improve their understanding of wildlife, tolerance for wildlife, knowledge base, and things like that. And then also to try to get them to put as much wildlife habitat in their yard or those common spaces in those neighborhoods where they live as possible to benefit wildlife. And the return is, a lot of times, I think people really enjoy generally having wildlife around, especially birds and things like that. But you know, as you start putting habitat on the ground, there's a whole host of other benefits for you. I mean,
right.
There's economic benefits because a lot of times you can resell your house quicker for more money. There's ecosystem services. So if you've got bats or swallows or something like that flying around, they're eating a lot of those insects that we don't necessarily appreciate, like mosquitoes. So we can't sit outside a lot of times at night. Or the more vegetation you have on the ground, the more flood control you've got and things like that. So there's a lot of benefit if you start doing things for wildlife, that also will come back and benefit the human population.
And that balance is really important for a good quality of life,
yeah,
don't you think?
Absolutely. There's enough studies out there now that are showing that, you know, there's decreased amounts of depression and mental illness, or I shouldn't say mental illness, but depression, improved physical health and things like that. Mm-hmm. In areas where you have a lot of habitat on the ground, because people are out walking and they feel better when they're looking at, you know, beautiful plants than if they're just looking at a sterile environment where maybe their house is and things like that. So yeah, it's wonderful, and I probably shouldn't say this on the radio, but most of the time I can't believe they pay me to do this job.
I have the same feeling.
I feel very, very lucky.
It's good when you go to work and it's not work, right?
It is awesome.
It's wonderful.
Absolutely awesome.
And I think that you just got a little bit of press last year about a study that you were doing. Is that correct? What was that about?
Well, so one of my feature projects, and again, as I mentioned, I try to really integrate my research program with my extension program, and one of the featured programs I've got, both research and extension, is what we call the UW Urban Canid Project. So for the last 6 or so years, we've been radio collaring and live trapping and radio collaring red fox and coyotes in the city of Madison and following them around. And so there's a lot of people who have a great interest in those animals for a whole variety of reasons, both, you know, interest out of some trepidation, but also interest out of just enjoyment. And so we do a lot of outreach and extension relative to that, pushing out a lot of our research results and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So we're lucky that people are interested in that, and occasionally the media picks up some of the stuff we're doing.
Yeah, I believe we did a couple of stories. So if you're interested in reading more, you can go to WPR.org and just Google what would be a good way.
Yeah,
to...
so UW Urban Canid, C-A-I, C as in Charlie, A-N-I-D as in Delta Project.
Okay.
And we have probably the best place to go is our project Facebook page. It's an open Facebook page. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to join it or to view it. And that gets updated pretty regularly, and it's a pretty good source of information.
Excellent. Well, thanks for sharing that with us.
Well, thanks for asking.
Yeah, let's go back to our phones. We had Jackie in Sun Prairie who's next. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there. Very interesting and kind of widespread discussion you're having today, and thank you for taking my call. One of the questions that I have a question and a story, so I don't know how long I have. But
be concise, Jackie. Be concise.
Your guest remarked that they think that the latest coronavirus from China in Wuhan was from bats. And then the television and the radio and all of the media has been saying that people had picked that up from a live animal market. Now, do they have bats in the live animal market? I don't think so. So do you know what the connection is there?
Well, so I think they're still trying to genotype the virus and the actual source of the virus as I understand it. So they're still trying to unravel the connection between those live animal markets and the people who showed up with the virus and the wildlife populations of bats. So I'm not sure that they've connected all the dots on that yet. And I think that they may be, in addition, that there's this person-to-person transmission now as well, which is complicating the story a little bit. So, but the point that I guess I was trying to make is that these coronavirus, this particular one, originates in bats. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a live animal market, you may have vendors who are out in an area where bats are flying around as free-flying species, and they're interacting with those domesticated or those caged or captive animals. And then that might jump from that captive animal to people at the live market. Mm-hmm. So that, I'm not saying that's exactly what's happening, but that is a scenario that could be feasible.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Well, thanks for helping us clarify that, Jackie. Let's go back to the phones now. We've got Norman in Wausau with a question. Hi, Norman.
Hi. I just wanted to mention to your guests that the business about the rough grouse being very tame apparently is more common than what he expects, because a few years back, a friend of mine and I were out in the woods where they were making popple pulp. He was helping them not too far from the city of Wausau. And he says, you know, I got this tame grouse out here. He said, just stay here a second, I'll call him. And he'd call grousey, grousey. And here comes this grouse through the brush. And he was so friendly, got up on a log by me, even got up on my shoulder. But I was afraid he might peck my eye. Also got up on the tires of the tractor they were using to haul the logs and stuff out. And he tried to get into the car with the window down. And if a bird came over, like a crow or something, that thing would make a funny sound and it would disappear into the brush in an instant.
Yeah.
In a few minutes, it would come back again very slowly. If you called it, it would come back. And it stayed around in that general area, I would say, for, at least 3 or 4 months. And then one day it was gone. And I don't know if some hunter who thought, boy, this is an easy grouse to shoot, shot it or what. But one day it was there no more.
Huh. Interesting. Mm-hmm. That's a neat story. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Norman. Let's go on to Kathy, and she's in Fifield.
Yes.
What question do you have for us?
I had a few comments. Science Magazine in September of 2019 published recent research on bird numbers, and they did find that raptors and waterfowl have gone up by over 50% in the past 50 years due to legislation that have supported them, you know, banning DDT and supporting wetlands and such, but that numbers of our small perching birds have declined significantly. In fact, they estimate a loss of $3 billion over the past 50 years, 29% gone. This would be for loss in habitat, collisions, mm-hmm. on and on. And then I'd like to just bring up, too, that recently, the Trump administration has reinterpreted the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which was protecting our migratory birds, our warblers and raptors and so on. But what it has done, it's eliminated the penalties for incidental bird deaths. Now, up to this point, you know, when there's an oil spill or such, there's a requirement to restore the habitat, so the birds continue to exist. That's gone now. If birds are killed because of industrial activity or even state activity, nothing needs to be. And birds are killed accidentally in the thousands or. Nothing needs to be done for them, so yeah. I think it's important to contact legislators about the migratory.
Yeah.
Okay, Kathy. Thanks. I think we get your point.
Yeah,
there,
that's a so. Good. I saw that mm-hmm. article in Science as well, and that's
right. a lot of people did.
An interesting story. Mm-hmm. Interesting results about that, and you know, birds are pretty resilient. I know that there's a lot of concern about legislation and all the different ways that bird mortality occurs and things like that. And no doubt some populations are declining. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But birds are pretty resilient, and I think if we can help them with habitat and some other bird conservation measures that, you know, we'll see hopefully rebounds in the population and they'll reverse some of those declines.
Yeah, we've also seen studies that are showing that our insect population has really gone down.
Yeah.
Isn't that a relationship that could be connected?
Possibly, especially for birds who are insectivores,
right.
if that's what they're eating. Yeah. Yeah, it possibly could be for sure.
And a lot of the songbirds
yep.
are, aren't they?
Yep, yep.
Yeah.
Well, everything kind of generates some habitat, so you've got to put the food, water, and space on the land, and mm-hmm. you know, animals will respond to that.
Right. And as far as the legislation goes, thank you, Kathy. And as always, if you know, be aware of what's going on and do let your legislators know how you feel about these different topics. So thanks, Kathy. Next up, let's go to Green Bay. Hi, Brandon. What can we help you with today?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the pheasant population, how that's going. I've seen quite a few pheasants together on the side of the road. And I don't know how they're all raising that, and then they go out in the wild. How does that impact the population standpoint for Wisconsin?
Well, so most pheasants that you see out there are stock birds. So they've been captive reared, and then they're released for hunting opportunities. So, you know, as they will stock those birds in the fall for hunting opportunities, some of those birds will carry over through the winter. Not a lot of them, but some do. And so that's probably what you're seeing now, is that those birds that did not get hunted in those areas, or again, depending on where you are, if the DNR is not stocking them, there are people who raise pheasants captively as private individuals, and sometimes those pheasants will get out, they'll escape, and you'll see the birds around there. But the population is we don't necessarily have a self-sustaining wild population of pheasants in the state of Wisconsin. And nor should we, because I know a lot of people like to hunt pheasants. They're a huge game bird, very popular, but they're not native to Wisconsin, and they're not native to the United States, as a matter of fact. So, there is some literature in the wildlife journals about some of these ringneck pheasants actually nest parasitizing some of our native grouse species, like sharp-tailed hawks or sharp-tailed grouse or prairie chickens. So there may be some detriment actually to having the pheasants on the landscape with some of our native grouse.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks for bringing that up, Brandon. That, lots of stuff I did not know. Next up, we'll go to Bayview and talk with Brian. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
What do you have for us?
I'm one of these people that sits in his backyard and likes to watch the birds because we don't travel that much. And we've got a large mulberry tree and three juniper trees. And every year for the last few years, we've noticed a single male cardinal, and he tends to have a harem of 12 to 14 females. Is that normal for a male cardinal to have a harem like that?
That seems a little excessive.
That's a lot.
but cardinals are starting to call now. You'll hear their call. And they're starting to call and start to advertise their breeding services here pretty soon. So it's not uncommon that they're starting to attract the females. And what's probably doing it more than him is that you've got those juniper trees and those mulberry trees that are loaded with berries right now. And it's a great, great source of food, especially at this time in wintertime. So it's probably a combination, and it probably has more to do with the food than it does with him.
Okay. All right, Brian. Well, have fun in your backyard. I'm sure you'll be seeing a lot more birds coming up. Let's go next to Joey. Joey's in Westby. What question do you have for us, Joey?
Hi. I got a pond in the backyard, and I don't know, it's about 40, 60 feet deep. And I had a family of otters living on it this summer and fall. And I still see tracks kind of intermittently in the winter. And I'm just wondering, what are they eating? I don't have any fish stocked in there at all. There are a lot of frogs and tadpoles and things. But what are they eating, and will they come back?
Joey, is the pond that you're describing, is it a closed pond or an open pond? And by that I mean, is there a water source that's coming in and out of that pond, or is it just a pond and there's no other water source attached to it?
It's an old quarry, and so it's rather deep, and they hit the springs, so it does overflow. It's got about a 2 to 4 gallon overflow per minute.
Okay, but is there an opportunity for fish to come into that system somehow?
Not really. No.
Okay.
So there's really no fish in the area.
Yeah. So they will travel, or they'll move across land to other. And I'm not sure what the rest of the landscape looks like around that pond, but if there's other ponds around, it very possible that they're actually maybe coming to that quarry and they don't have to only eat fish. They'll eat other things that might be in there, like frogs or snakes or whatever the case might be too. So, but it's very possible they're just coming in there to use the pond to play or to see if there's an opportune meal in there. And then if there's not, then they might be leaving that quarry area and going to another nearby pond that may have a better stock fish supply or food supply or whatever the case might be.
Okay, great. Thanks, Joey. How fun.
Yeah, isn't that
oh
neat?
My gosh, the otters are wonderful
they
to watch.
They are awesome animals.
Yeah, I hope they come back for you, Joey. We talked a little bit about the Garden Expo earlier, David. Let's make sure everybody knows that it starts Friday at noon, I believe.
That's right.
And it goes through Sunday afternoon.
Yep, I think until 4 o'clock
I
or
believe
so.
You are correct. If you like to listen to our show, I think probably half the presenters have been on, so it's a really good place to go. You've been there before. What can people expect when they go to the Garden Expo?
Yeah, it gets you all jazzed up to start gardening, and then everybody gets ready to go, and then you go outside, and we've got 3 more months of frozen soil. So, but it's a good time to start thinking about what you're going to plant. And again, you know, it's directed toward, I think a lot of people are directed toward vegetable gardens and things like that. But there's a lot of stuff that as you walk around there, and I'm going to bring it back to wildlife and urban wildlife in particular, but there's a lot of things that you can plant or think about that will benefit wildlife species that are living in your neighborhood or in your yard or your city or whatever the case might be. So, and there's not only do you have a lot of vendors there to that are selling seeds or plants or
bird feeders,
all sorts of stuff like that. But throughout the entire Garden Expo, they have speakers that are talking about, you know, like Jamie and I are talking about wildlife stuff, but they've got speakers that are talking about insects and pollinators and different ways to plant things and cultivars and all sorts of stuff like that. So it's just a wealth of information and just a concentrated source of resources all in one spot. Yeah,
and Larry and I and Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston will be doing a seminar. Basically, it's garden talk, but that's going to be at 9:30 on Saturday morning.
Yep.
So we'd
Excellent.
Love to see some people come out and say hello. And speaking of saying hello, Russ in Stoughton, can we have one quick question before we have to go? Hi, Russ.
Yeah, real quick. I moved to Wisconsin from Illinois in 2008 and been a bird feeder for years and years. And I had, 40, 50 juncos, you know, show up every year at end of October and leave in early April. And last year I had none. And this year there's maybe six or eight. I was wondering what was going on with the junco population.
You know, I don't think anything's going on with it because I've seen bunches of juncos around where I live, and I bike to work usually every day. I see them on my bike route, bike ride into work. So I don't know that anything is going on, but similar to an earlier caller on the show, you know, she's mentioning that she hasn't had to refill her feeders once this winter. And again, especially down in the southern part of the state, we've had a relatively mild winter. So there's a lot of food around is available. So the juncos aren't necessarily needing to concentrate at a bird feeder, for example. And possibly there's other people in your area who are feeding as well, and it might be kind of dispersing the junco, so they're not all at one spot like you've maybe seen them in years past.
Okay, thank you, Russ. And we've had people that a lot of callers, listeners that have called in and said, you know, I don't see fill in the blank bird anymore. And usually we answer and say, well, similar to what you had said. Here's some of the reasons. What time frame do you really need before you can say, you know, there probably is a dip in the population or they're just not there anymore.
Yeah.
What's the time frame you use?
Well, I think certainly probably more than one,
more
than one season. So probably two or three seasons.
For sure.
And obviously, I think you would also want to look at a larger regional scope because if it's just a neighborhood or a yard, you know, that's not a big deal. But if it's across maybe the migratory pathway or something like that, then maybe you start thinking about there's something really is going on population-wide here.
Okay. So if they're not coming to your bird feeder this year, don't panic.
Yeah, don't panic. The other thing is go on eBird for Wisconsin.
Great idea.
Is another great place because people are reporting all sorts of bird sightings on there.
Mm-hmm.
And just see what people are reporting and see if people are reporting juncos or whatever bird that you're not seeing. See if other people are reporting it or saying the same thing you are.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So it's eBird.com, right?
Yeah, I believe that's it.
Yeah, and anybody can post anything.
Yep. Or if you just Google it. If it's not .com, just Google eBird in Wisconsin. It should pop right up.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thank you once again, David, for all of your great information, as usual.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure. We've been talking with David Drake. He's a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. He's going to be back with us on March 4th, about a month from now. Tomorrow at 11, it's time to look at the list of 2019's top 10 consumer complaints with our guests from the Bureau of Consumer Protection. That's tomorrow right here on the Ideas Network. And don't forget to take a look at our blog. There's always stuff on there that's new, a little bit more in-depth of what we're doing here. Just go to WPR.org/Larry to see what's there. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network.